get a voicemail. Listen to the voicemail. And like, I lost my mind. Basically saying, hey, this is Angela Bassett. Which already was
what
like,
do you even what say? Is
it like? What? Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Envelope Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Yvonne Biadia.
Sean Finney.
And I'm Mark Olson.
We got another great episode with two incredible interviews. Sean, why don't you tell us who you spoke with?
I spoke with the multi-talented Asia Naomi King. We really, really know her from How to Get Away with Murder, but she's starring in Lessons in Chemistry opposite Brie Larson. And honestly, have you all seen the show yet?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a show about dreams and identity. It follows Elizabeth Zott, who is Brie Larson's character, who is once has dreams and aspirations to be a scientist, but society is basically saying you don't belong here as a woman. And it just follows an interesting time in our American culture in the 1950s, 60s. And Asia's character to me is so interesting because she has dreams of her own, but she's also kind of thrusted into protecting her community. And she forms this relationship with Elizabeth Zott, Brie Larson's character. And great conversation with Asia. We talked about her upbringing. And honestly, we talk about this too, Mark, just like what it actually takes to do this job as acting. And she speaks very candidly about her upbringing and her mom and her relationship with how they really believed in her and how that kept her in moments when she wasn't getting the gig. So we had a really good conversation.
Well, I also like that her character in the book is different than the one we see on screen.
We spoke about that, yeah, too, which so is interesting. Yeah, because, yeah, her character in the book did not look the same as Asia Naomi King. And that was very intentional from the director. And it was a decision that they had made. And they really expanded upon her character, too, which we got to see in her playing Harriet Sloan. Yeah. What about you?
Well, I spoke with the creative minds behind Elsbeth, which is this new procedural on CBS, and it sort of takes a page from Columbo. So this is a show from Michelle and Robert King, who were the duo behind The Good Wife and The Good Fight. And this takes one of the characters from those shows and sort of launches her in New York. But they're not really calling it a spinoff because the tone is different. It's more comedic and it's like not as serialized. So we talk a little about that. It centers on Elsbeth Tassioni, who in The Good Fight and The Good Wife is this lawyer. But now that she's in New York, she's sort of taking on a more detective role as she sort of keeps her eye on the NYPD and their investigations. And she's sort of seeing, like, are they doing things right? But she's also keeping tabs on the captain of the police squad. So it's very interesting. So I spoke with Michelle, but also showrunner Jonathan Tolins about, you know, giving her this different backdrop. So it was fun.
Well, that sounds really great, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes. But first, we have Sean's interview with Asia Naomi King.
Welcome back to The Envelope. My name is Sean Finney, and today I am sitting with the force that is Asia Naomi King, and we are talking about all things Miss Harriet Sloan and Lessons in Chemistry. How are you feeling?
I am feeling so... Thank you. I'm just like... Thank you for having me.
But first, because I really believe who we are really impacts what we do and why. So I'm going to go back to a place called Walnut.
Walnut,
Little
California.
Asia, with no cell phone.
Oh, God.
When all you had was your imagination. And how that really impacted and led you to Yale and gave you this idea and courage about acting.
So, okay. So for me to actually do that, then I have to take it back even further.
Let's go further.
I've got to take it back to my mother, Teresa Moore King, who grew up in New York, and all she wanted to do was create. All she did was, like, from, you know, well, also, like, growing up in like the 50s, 60s, New York, just her and her sisters making their own clothes, like renting out clubs and putting on fashion shows and charging people tickets to do this.
Oh, innovation.
Like, honey, let me tell you. So, Teresa, the foundation of everything that I am, she continues to inspire me just with her joy of life. And so being raised by that kind of woman who only ever saw possibility, like that's where it began for me. And it's funny because, like, even when you have parents like mine who just, like, I'd be like, I want to run track and field. I want to be a cheerleader. I want to be in an honors program. I want to do, like, they were just like, all right, go ahead and do it. Like, we worked this hard to get this far so that
whatever thought popped into your mind, you could just go and do and not think about it twice. But of course, as you grow older, the world, society, tries to teach you something else and make you feel like those things aren't as possible.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That they're not within grasp.
Yeah.
That is a flight of fancy.
Yeah.
And it really has been my parents and their belief in me that allowed me to even begin to pursue this. So little Asia could have all these dreams because I had the backup. I had my army of ancestors just saying, go on ahead. We won't let anything get in your way.
Who is it? Oh, okay.
It's like, so that's like,
yeah.
that's where I began. Because when I think about, like, my mom in New York doing all this stuff.
And at that time.
At that time.
Yeah.
Right? And then she came out to L.A. and was like, oh, well, I can conquer this.
Yeah.
I could do this here, too. And so her just having that, like, strength and passion and vision and endowing me and my little sisters with that, you know, like, that became, like, the baseline for our lives. But then, you know, you go to school and you meet other kids and you see how difficult things can be, especially when you don't believe in yourself, especially when you don't have anyone telling you that you should believe in yourself. You know, and so then the idea of doing this was like, oh no, like
that's for somebody else.
That's for somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, or the version of this that I could do would never look
or amount
like
to
this. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like I can't, like I won't be Angela. You
yeah,
know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like there's only
there's
one
only
her.
One. Yes.
You
still
know,
is, still is only one. Her.
Still is only
yes,
one.
Yes.
Let it be known, Angela Bassett. But and that you know what, and that played a role too. Like for us, we knew who
yeah.
these incredibly
yes.
talented black women, these powerful forces of nature, we knew who they were, but they, for us growing
yeah.
up, they weren't totally mainstream.
Yes, no.
Yet.
They were ours.
They were ours.
Yes.
You know, and
yeah.
that was so special
yeah.
to have that.
Yeah.
But it became a limiting idea of what was possible because, and now I think they have been given so much, but at that time, they should have been given so much more.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So it was hard to enter into this with the idea of like, so then what is going to look like for me? Because I don't think I can get to where they are. And like, and they already deserve so much more than what they're getting.
Yeah, they're on back order for all of the
like,
things that
exactly,
are to come. Exactly. Yeah.
Right? But then I guess I had my come to Jesus moment. And the thing that I was trying to do, the person I was trying to become, I was failing at.
Mm.
Because it wasn't truly in my spirit to be that. I was trying to be a doctor. Ooh! And I mean, when I tell you, I get sick of the sight of blood.
Yeah.
Like, it ooh. I mean, I love people.
But I don't want to bandage
you
up.
I don't want to bandage you up.
No.
I don't want to see you hurt.
Yeah.
You know? yeah, don't.
But that's also like a perceived idea of society's version of success.
Yes.
And what success is. So you even probably pursuing that was like, this is successful.
But also, let me tell you something. It's not only the perceived idea of what success is, it is also the idea of what safety is. Like this.
Oh, Asia, we're doing this
safe.
Today.
Safe. Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, let's do this.
We can talk.
Yeah, yeah, we're doing this.
Like,
okay.
Right? It's like yeah. now you add value.
Yes.
Like this will keep you safe. Mm-hmm. This will keep your family safe. You
provide.
Will have somewhere to go. You can provide. You will be necessary. So there was such a safety in that idea. And then going outside of the bounds of that safety, I basically had a nervous breakdown in high school. Because I felt like I was defying so much within myself, that safety that I desired, by going out on a limb and pursuing acting, pursuing a creative art.
That was a career.
That as a career.
In college, in studying.
Like, yeah. Like, that was in that. And it's so funny because my parents, they never thought it was insane. They never said to me, that's crazy. Don't do that. Like, it was
the world,
all the oppressive societal ideas that made me feel like, that's crazy. You can't do that. And so I had like a whole little, like, I just remember like sobbing to my mom, like, I can't be a doctor. I can't do this, you know?
You're probably feeling like you're letting them down.
Like all this self-imposed, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember them holding me and just being like, that's okay. You know, like, we want you to be happy. Mm. Like, we didn't do all this for you to struggle in some idea of what you're supposed to be, you know? And it blew my mind because I was looking at them like, but no, don't you understand? Like, you're supposed to convince me that, like, I'm doing the wrong thing, guys. I'm going in the wrong direction. And they were just like,
no. We overstand, actually.
We overstand.
Yeah.
We overstand that there is this huge desire in your heart. And also, they thought I was good at it.
Yeah.
Like, they saw success for me in this beyond what I could see for myself. I'm like, maybe that's love or parenting. I don't know, but I hope I'm able to do the same thing for my child too.
It's freedom, it sounds like.
Right?
Yeah, freedom to dream.
Like, right? To believe so much in someone else that it grants them a freedom that they never thought that they could experience them for themselves. You know, like, so yes. So that is...
No, that's beautiful because I feel like, and you've mentioned her name already, but I know that when you got accepted to Yale, you got a phone call from a certain individual.
Oh, yes.
I think a missed call.
A missed call.
And then you heard the voicemail and you called her back. Tell us a little bit about that story because I think it's important as we talk about powerful figures, even in your character,
yes,
for Lessons in Chemistry. Just tell me that story.
So, okay. So imagine me. I was about to go. So at this point, I've done undergrad.
Okay.
I've gone to UC Santa Barbara. I'm still pursuing acting. I'm going to grad school. I've gotten accepted into Yale University's MFA acting program.
Because we were good. Because we're good.
Yeah. Because other people saw the talent too now.
Because it wasn't just me.
It wasn't just my parents. And the Angela Bassett calls my cell phone.
Because your mom's friend knew
her. My mom had a friend who knew her, and my mom was talking to that friend, didn't ask for that, was just telling her friend how excited she was for me. That friend, like, got a message to Angela, got her my cell phone number. I'm like, what? She calls me, I get a call on my cell phone from a private number.
We don't answer those.
Yeah. Like,
we don't need those. They're calling to ask for something we don't want to give.
Like, exactly. Like, I don't know what this is. Get a voicemail. Listen to the voicemail. And, like, I lost my mind because Angela Bassett left me a message saying, just basically saying, hey, this is Angela Bassett, which already was like,
what do you even say?
Like, what? I heard you got into Yale. Just give me a call. I'll call you back later. Like, oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Casually.
And she did. She, cause I was like, oh, and then what do you do?
You scream.
Hold your phone.
Look at it.
Stand there staring at it.
Like,
Angela says she's going to call back. So I'm just going to stand here and wait for Angela to call back. And she called. We've never met. I mean, we have met now,
but not met at that time.
She called me back, and we talked on the phone probably for like 30, 45 minutes.
Wow.
And she told me about her experience of that school, her experience of being a black woman in this industry, and how you have to fight for yourself and believe in your vision of yourself and what you deserve. But for me, actually, the best piece of advice that she gave me on this call was, while at school especially, to just be open, to be open to all the direction, to play, to truly play and be open and explore it and see where it takes you, to go on that journey,
mm-hmm,
you know, and then decide if that feels right and to make an acting choice based off of that. And that has kind of been my, like, my guiding light in terms of how I work, like just to believe in openness and collaboration and play and to, like, fully do the choice and to see where it takes you, explore that, and then let it go if it's not going to serve the character, and allow yourself to go in a different direction, allow yourself to make a mistake, allow yourself to fail. And it was just really beautiful. But I guess kind of the most beautiful thing she taught me in that moment of her taking the time to
call you back,
to call me back,
yeah,
to share this advice with a perfect stranger, is the art and the generosity of paying that forward, of giving that to another up-and-coming artist, to be willing to have that conversation, to spend that time to engage. It's something that, like, regardless of where that person ends up on their journey, that they will cherish forever, because you took the time to say, talking to you means something to me. Mm-hmm. I think you are valuable, mm-hmm, and important, and I want to share what I have learned with you. And we have to pass that on. We can't gatekeep these gifts.
And you're important now. Because I think what's the interesting part is sometimes the importance isn't until the accolades or the awards or the nominations. Yeah. And it's like, oh, no, you're important as a student.
Yes.
And be a student and play and learn, yes, and listen and love and fall in love with that and then apply it there.
Yes.
Oh, see, Angel, we're gonna need a part two.
Because I just love the way you broke that.
We're going to need a part two. Because I feel like I'm curious now how this goes into lessons in chemistry, right?
Yes.
You, not TV, film, we've done it. Now we're at that point. Now we've done it. We've had the moments crying in the ABC lobby,
yes,
figuring out who's got the role. Like, we have those things happening, right?
I feel like you know my entire
life. And so what now is a hell yes? Like, when you are being presented an opportunity to be a part of a project, like, what is the hell yes factor? And then what was the hell yes about this script for you specifically?
In general, the hell yes factor, mm-hmm, is like the people that you get to work with. Mm. That's where I'm like, oh, I really want that experience. Like, you get to work with Viola Davis.
Yes. Yes, please.
Hell yes. Like, how much?
Yeah, I'll pay you.
Right. And with this, it was like, you get to work with Brie Larson. Like,
yeah.
I love her.
Yes.
Hell yes.
Yes.
You know? And I just love that my life has taken me, that my career has taken me in this direction to work with such incredibly generous artists who give so much and are just so kind and loving, like on and off set. And then for this script specifically, when I first read it, well, okay, I got the script and I was like, should I read the book first? Should I read the script first?
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, really, like, listen. And I decided to read the book first to have a framework. I sobbed through this book.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the book was so beautiful.
Yep.
And then I read the script and I was like, wow, they really did it. They really
expanded.
They really did it. So, but let me say. So then, in having conversation with our showrunner, Lee Eisenberg, what I had originally sort of joined the project to do was going to undergo some changes.
Okay.
And then I was like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Like, cause I like what we're...
I fell in love with what we were, yeah.
Like, right, so what are we going to do?
What does this mean?
And then he proceeded to tell me this whole beautiful story of what he wanted to do with my character. And it was kind of taking over, because originally I wasn't really Harriet from, mm-hmm, the book.
Yes.
I was something else.
Yeah.
And then he was like, we want you to be Harriet. And of course, immediately in my mind, I'm like, this is one of the favorite characters of the book. And you know how people get.
And then if I'm going to come in,
and then what are you going to do with this?
Yeah.
Make it make sense.
Yeah.
And what he pitched to me in that moment, I found so powerful and so inspiring. And I was like, you know, when you get that moment, like that thing, like when you look, like you feel like a little kid, and you're like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
Like, and that's how I felt.
That's what
I
want to
like,
be a part.
We're gonna dive into like some black motherhood, and
being a wife, her full life,
and her aspirations beyond those two things that, in a time period, that was what was meant to define you, and she's going to be defying all of that.
Yeah.
And she's an activist?
Yes.
What? Like, what?
She's a superhero.
Basically.
Yeah.
Basically a superhero.
Yeah.
And then to dive into this story of this neighborhood. And, like, And you know, there was a part of me that was like, ooh, he could just be saying this because a lot of the time people can be full of S-H-I-T.
Yes, yes, yes.
And yes. I was just like, can I trust this man?
Yeah.
When he says all this stuff about the story we're going to tell, is that going to be like...
the actual story that's in the show
right?
that people see. Not exactly. What we filmed.
Not what, yeah. Right? And yeah. It's like, or is it going to be like, oh, like, there's a line like, oh, I'm so mad at my husband. And then we move on to
yes.
talk, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and that's it.
Yeah.
And when I tell you, as I got script after script after script, and they just weave together this beautiful story of Harriet's life, like showing the tension that was being built with my husband, showing like the dichotomy between Elizabeth's experience yeah. of life and Harriet's experience of struggle. Yeah.
This protest is about people all over this country struggling to be seen, begging to be treated with dignity. You're always talking about the things that keep women down, but who does that include? Have you looked at your audience lately? Now, I'm working my corner of the ring, but you've got something almost no one has. You have a platform. What you say matters. And what you don't say matters just as much. You want to make it up to me? Think about the kind of person you want to be.
I was so grateful that it wasn't some side character. Like
whose story pops in for a moment, for an episode.
Like, but it's only used
yes.
so that we can learn more about the
yep.
main character.
Yeah.
Like, no, we stay with her. We live with her. We
yeah.
understand her deeply.
Yeah.
Like, we see what she's fighting for, and we see the effect of that, not only on her husband, but on her children. And
her relationship with Elizabeth.
And her relationship with Elizabeth.
And what she taught her.
Like, right. And that being called into question. And
yeah.
them having to earn that
relationship.
Friendship,
yeah.
Which, like, and we had discussions about that because that was so fundamental for us in building this community, that it was all earned, that you got to see it all so that you know we earned it. You could believe these two would be in each other's lives
yes.
because they have a transparency
yes.
with one another.
And an accountability.
Yes.
And an honesty.
Yes.
And a responsibility, I think,
yes.
once you delve deeper. There was a scene specifically, this is what I was going to mention later, but a scene where Harriet was basically saying, like, look, I need you to show up for me. Like, if you're really about this life, I need you to show up for me. And Elizabeth's character was like, I'll make it up to you. Like, I'll see you another
like,
time.
Right?
Like, this is not my birthday.
Exactly.
This is not a...
It's like, this is not about me.
No, and this is really about the collective we.
Yes, exactly.
Regardless of what you look like and
like,
I
right?
look like.
Right, it's like, this is the neighborhood that we live in.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that I loved about Harry. It's like, she's not just trying to save this neighborhood for herself or the
yeah.
people that look like her. Elizabeth lives there, too.
Yeah.
You know? And like, and that's what I found so profound about it. Like that, I know exactly the scene you're talking
yeah,
about because
yeah.
I love that one so much because she calls into question to Elizabeth's audience. And it's
yes.
like, who was this for?
Yeah.
You know, like, and do you understand the impact
yeah.
that you are able to make? And what is the point if there's no deeper purpose?
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's like you can't pitch all this stuff about how you want equality and femininity. And
it only applies to some.
Exactly.
I mean, it's interesting because I feel like the underlayer for me watching it is the dreams and identity.
Yes.
And like the dreams deferred, dreams realized, revealed,
yes.
Harriet's dreams. And then when her husband comes back, like, okay, I can go for my dreams. But now my dreams are being, I have to protect my dreams.
Yes.
And then the identity of like, there's things that I have access to, you have access to. I'm curious for you, like, what that intersectionality of Harriet's character is as it relates to dreams and identity.
Well, that's what I love that we got to really see with this show.
Yeah.
Like, because she's growing up in a time where she's supposed to be content with the identity of mm-hmm. wife and mother,
mm-hmm.
you know, and...
Because that was success at the
that
time.
That was success. That was safety.
Yes, that was safety.
That was safety.
Yes.
And so going beyond those bounds, trying to work... trying to be a further educated,
yeah.
like aspiring to all of that, like, and then, because I loved how we did this, I loved how her idea of safety and her husband's idea of safety were two different ideas.
Separate.
Very separate. His was you keep your head down, you do your work, you earn your money, your kids get to go to a nice school and be safe and live. While her idea of safety is We have to change the society within where we live, or else our children will never be safe. They will never have a future. They will never get to live. And getting to see them have that conversation, to me, was really essential in understanding what Black parenthood is now, today, and has continued to be. And so her identity and her dreams from the outside are in conflict with one another, because she dreams for so much more. But for herself, her dreams are not separate from her identity, because that is who she is. She is someone who takes action. She was always going to take action, regardless of whatever box someone wanted to put her in. She was always going to explore a way out of that and trying to expand people's ideas and possibilities of what, of not only what they could be, but what she herself could be. And I think too, and I won't limit it to just motherhood, but I do think there is something about motherhood that expands you in such a way, because you know if you're not living life to the fullest, how can your children ever begin to think that they could do that? Mm-hmm. Like, if you can't expand your own bounds of your mind to what is possible for yourself, like, then our children will remain in these tiny, limited boxes
perpetuating an idea.
Exactly. That society, like, society creeps in.
Yeah.
No matter what you do.
Yeah.
You know, my parents tried to tell me I had endless possibilities, but society crept in, because I would watch TV or I'd look at a magazine.
Yep.
And I'd be like, oh, I don't look like these people, so this is not for me.
Yes.
So now imagine being in a time, oh, my God.
Really? Yeah.
Right?
And there were laws put in place.
Laws.
Yeah.
Covenants. That said you cannot live here.
Yeah.
You cannot buy anything here. I mean, a period in a time where a woman couldn't have a credit card unless a man signed off on it.
Yeah.
You know, like, that you didn't own your own being.
Had,
like,
no agency.
You had no agency.
Yeah.
But imagine growing up in a time where you have no agency and having the audacity to think, I should.
And can and will.
And can and will. That I deserve to have agency, and I will fight to bend your mind to believe it too.
Mm.
And like, and that is who Harriet is.
Whew. That right there. And scene. No, but honestly, because I feel like, you know, I know that you also had a cultural consultant on set. Is it Dr. Bell?
Dr. Shamel Bell.
Dr. Shamel Bell.
Yes.
And I can only imagine learning about the real, like, Sugar Hill.
Yes.
And, like, understand. And the thing about it is, you had a Hattie McDaniel, you had a Ray Charles, you had influential.
This was an affluent Black,
yes,
neighborhood that was destroyed by the Highway Commission.
Yeah.
Because they had a choice to put it through Sorority Row near USC, or to uproot all these families using eminent domain. Mm. We all know how that,
yep,
goes down.
Yep.
just displacing this entire community.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's not okay to do it anywhere, but to just know that there was so much art and creativity, these salons happening, this, like, cultural epicenter of this joyful life,
yeah,
just being
ripped
broken
apart.
Up.
For Highway.
You know? And it's devastating. And I didn't even know about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had no idea.
Mm-hmm. That it occurred.
That it happened. That right there in downtown. Like.
And do you think, because learning that too, like, learning it, it's historical knowledge now coming to, yes, understand it, and then living in that character again, but.
Yeah.
The audacity of dreaming, I'm just curious for you, like, how did that impact you? Because I feel like the questions typically are like, tell us about the strong woman in your life. And I'm like, how did this make you a different person? I won't,
yes,
even say woman, just a different person. This character.
Yeah.
What lives with you from Harriet?
I mean, in learning about this, you know, it's one of those things where you're like, okay, not surprised.
Yeah.
Like, of course.
Duh.
Like,
right,
sure. You know, what's new? That's what you... Mm.
Yep.
Anyways.
Yep.
I love Harriet's vision. I really do. I'm like, my son is still young, but my son was very young when I was filming this. And It is. It is such a fine line we walk as parents, trying to give so much to your children and still have ownership over yourself, and still, it's like Harriet reminded me that I still owe something to myself in my own, like, moments of peace and joy that are separate from me as a mother. And it is so important to gift myself that, to understand that the idea of love is not wasting all that you have to give it to someone else so that there's nothing left for you. Mm-hmm. But that love should be, I am taking such great care of myself that you can learn
and
that
benefit from.
And that you can learn and benefit from.
Yeah.
And that you can understand that when you love someone, it is not to destroy yourself.
In pursuit of loving them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because I can't give my child the idea, and I can't parent or exist as a human being within the idea that I only did a good job of loving you if I had nothing left for me.
Yes.
Like, that's horrible
and
not sustainable. And I also would not want that for my son. I would not want him to love in that way, because I don't think that engenders respect or boundaries, which are really important things, which are essential to say, I matter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I still matter too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I will love you, but I will also love myself.
And I will hold some for myself.
Exactly.
I love that that's what you took from Harriet. I'm going to give you one last question, a lightning round question. You
guys, lightning round.
We can talk.
I know, and I'm loving this.
So I feel like lessons in chemistry is like a metaphor for life. So if it wasn't lessons in chemistry, lessons in blank, if you had to rename the title, because I was like lessons in love, lessons in life, but I'm curious, what would you call it? Lessons in blank.
Lessons in audacity.
Mm. I love that.
Because there's a daring to to the people in this story.
Yeah.
A boldness and a daring to at least try. To try to live the way you want to live, which you have to do with an unparalleled audaciousness.
Ooh. I love that. Isn't it, King? You are a queen. And did an incredible performance.
Thank you.
Incredible performance.
Thank you.
And then that. Yeah.
Thank you for this.
Thank you for joining.
Thank you.
After the break, we have Yvonne's interview with Michelle King and Jonathan Tolman.
John and Michelle, thanks so much for joining me.
Absolutely.
Congratulations are in order. You guys were renewed for season 2 of Elsbeth. Michelle, you've been in this position many times, but does getting a show renewal in today's landscape feel any more challenging or harder to predict than even 5 years ago?
Yes. It feels maybe a little bit more special because there are fewer shows, there are fewer spaces. So yeah, it was a thrill.
Mostly it was a feeling of relief because so much of the first season you just are constantly thinking of how do we get it beyond the first season? How do we earn that pickup? And so to get there, it's like, now it's going to be easy.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the genesis of this project. Michelle, you and Robert King, your husband and writing partner, were sort of looking for something that was less laborious to watch during the pandemic, right?
That's exactly
And you
right.
were sort of like, can we get something like Columbo? Talk to me about how it sort of then came to fruition.
We very much enjoyed Columbo during the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And we love Carrie Preston. We love Elsbeth Tassioni. Mm-hmm. They were just kind of a natural fit. And the idea... We weren't looking to continue the Good Wife universe, per se. And we actually didn't think we were continuing the Good... It was just, oh, that character fits so beautifully in that genre. Wouldn't that be fun?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the road.
Was it just a natural thing because she was conceived as a Columbo character? Like, there was no consideration of, let's start with a new character altogether?
No, never crossed our mind.
Mm-hmm.
No, we absolutely knew, oh, she's our gal for this show.
So how do you sort of think about, how do we build this out into something that is Columbo-esque?
just starting with okay, what is her world? She isn't a detective. Mm-hmm. She's a lawyer. So what is a logical way to get her involved with the police department? And then we like the idea of bringing her to New York, because mm-hmm. first of all, fish out of water, she's a Midwesterner, get to see New York and fancy New York mm-hmm. through her eyes, which was very appealing to us.
You know, I'm new to the city. Can you help me find an apartment?
Oh, I'd be glad to refer you to the appropriate broker.
I think I want you. Can I have you?
My plate is pretty full.
I'm more like a side dish. Do you have a card?
Oh. I rushed here from my office and forgot my bag. Too bad.
Dawn, you've worked on The Good Fight before. What do you get with Elsbeth at the center of a series that's different than Alicia in The Good Wife or Christine Baranski in The Good Fight?
What's the whole feeling? I mean, this is not a political show, which The Good Fight very much was. Mm-hmm. It's also not an sort of issue-based show, although we find, as writers, ways to sort of put in things we find interesting and comments on the world, you know, as in the course of our cases and all that. I mean, you know, this show is its own thing. It's this sort of very funny, serious cop show. One of the things we learned early on was that it works best when we play it like a very straight CBS procedural with this quirky character thrown in the middle of it, questioning everything. Mm-hmm. And I always say that this wasn't the plan, but somehow I ended up in the perfect position to work on this show, because the last three TV shows I did before this were The Good Fight, Schmigadoon, and East New York. Mm-hmm. And if you put those three shows in a blender, that's sort of how you end up with Elsbeth.
The Good Wife and The Good Fight, they open with these crystallizing moments for the main characters. But Elsbeth, as Michelle, you stated, it doesn't have the same sort of personal or introspective launching point. Like, we find that she's there sort of as an impartial observer of the NYPD on their murder investigations, but then we also later find out she's actually gathering evidence on Wendell Pierce's character, Captain Wagner, in this sort of police corruption investigation. How did you decide on that as, like, the launching point, and do you see any, like, sort of character development in this sort of weekly case format with her?
We knew we were doing an episodic show. That was our intention, as opposed to something like The Good Fight, which was far more heavily serialized. Mm-hmm. And taking Columbo as a model, you don't learn that much about Columbo. You don't go home with Columbo. So we're breaking the mold somewhat, but we're breaking it gently. Mm-hmm. And John and the writers are breaking it gently.
You're spending so much time with this character now, which is such a luxury because she's so delightful. We slowly peel the onion as we go. And one of the things we found that's very helpful is that what makes the show work, I think, well, is that each episode feels different because we pick a different slice of life, usually moneyed New York, and we dig into that and we build the case with that, and the clues come out of the specifics of that world, which always make it a little bit juicier and a little bit more fun.
He was so upset, he wanted to talk in person. Excuse me, what are you doing?
Your rug is missing. See, there's an outline where a rug used to be.
You're very observant.
Oh, no, not really. I just notice things that are odd.
But we also use the specifics of that case as a way to find some new aspect of Elsbeth that we learned something about. Like, mm-hmm. so when she was in a case where it was a high-priced matchmaker, she starts talking about her romantic history. So we just try to find organic, natural ways to sort of learn a little bit more about her. And one of the nice things is that she's in this sort of partnership with Kaya, mm-hmm. Kara Patterson's character. Kaya is our representative of trying to figure out this woman. So we're excited to have more and more time to find out things about her.
Well, and studios love, you know, remakes, reboots, franchises, but that comes with audience expectations. But what do you enjoy about, you know, working with a known character? What is the sort of creative challenge or joy of that for both of you?
In terms of audience expectation of a character, that the nice thing is one doesn't have to know the character from previous shows to enjoy this show. I mean, because studios test shows. And so they did the test, and the folks in the focus group were asked if they loved the show. They didn't know the character.
There were 19 shows with Elsbeth on them in across Good Wife and Good Fight. And so there's a voice that you can have in your head as a writer. And it's just so much of this is about just trying to listen to that sense of, does that feel right? Mm-hmm. And you have a lot more to go on when you have a character who's had that many outings and you can hear her in your head and just sort of follow that instinct.
Tell me what it was like in the Good Fight writer's room when you knew that you were going to be having Elsbeth in an episode.
It would always come out with, well, who would be a fun lawyer for this? And it's like, is Carrie Preston available? You know, that was always sort of the first question. And I have to say, I mean, happened to be the writer of record on the last two episodes that Elsbeth appeared on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of how I ended up with this job, mm-hmm. because I think Robert and Michelle liked the way I wrote her, mm-hmm. and thought of me when they started this. So, you know, always do your best.
What is the trick to writing her? Like, what can you have fun with in terms of dialogue and everything?
Here's the thing. I feel like they say, oh, she's quirky. A lot of that comes from that she will tell the truth about things. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think a lot of how you write her is, you pay attention to every little thing in your own head that notices something odd or weird or contradictory, mm-hmm. and you let the characters say it.
It's just, when the Russians assassinate someone, they're trying to make a point, you know, to scare the next person who thinks of speaking out.
Killing a tennis giant on the sport's biggest stage isn't making a point.
Well, except for you and a few people online, no one's really suggesting them, and their people haven't leaked anything to change that, so kind of defeats the purpose, doesn't it?
And also, one of the great things about writing for Carrie Preston is that you can do that in a line, and you don't have to put in parenthetical a new thought, or like she will find every divergent path, you know, mm-hmm. through the, which is so delightful.
Carrie talks a lot about how the pauses that are written in help her.
First time I heard her, you know, read through, it was actually the first show we filmed after the pilot, that it's coming out of her mouth the way I had it in my head, and that, so that I felt really confident that okay, she and I, we have a sort of mind meld about how this character thinks. Mm-hmm. Again, so much of it is instinct. I mean, mm-hmm. so much of it is not you decide how you're going to do it. You just have to follow that sort of unconscious sense of right. who the character is.
Because something that I love is just even how she enters a scene, like she'll just pop in the side.
Yeah. That's something that happened when Robert was directing the pilot.
I was going to say, that came about with Robert directing the pilot.
Really?
And
okay.
That fun sideways,
yes.
and then suddenly it became a signature.
And so is that then
that was
written?
Found.
That was found. Is it then written into scripts now? Or
oh, yes.
How? Okay.
Well, it's funny. I mean, in the finale, she, Elsbeth, I don't want to give too much away, but she's being trained to walk on a runway mm-hmm. in a fashion show, and this model played by Laura Benanti says, you know, stand up straighter, and she says, sorry, I tend to lean into things. So yeah, we pay attention to it, and all the directors like know that that's something, and they always find new fun ways for her to pop into frame.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, I know during the strike you spent part of that rewatching Columbo, or watching it for the first time.
I had seen some of them when I was a bunch of them when I was a kid, and some of them I really, watching them again, I totally remembered exactly, like the Ruth Gordon one, I totally remembered. But yeah, I watched all of them.
And talk to me about what that did for you and what the note taking was like. I mean, what you were looking for in terms of how they worked with clues or what kind of cases they were doing.
Yeah, what I tried to do is I paid attention to what I found I liked the best. Like what I like when I felt like, oh, that's a really good thing. And I think the thing that makes it work at the best is when, and this is a very TV thing to say, but it's like when you can play at home. Mm-hmm. Like I love it when the whole thing hinges on a clue that I should have seen. Mm-hmm. I had every opportunity to see that and I didn't see it. And that's really the fun. So we try to do that as often as we can.
How was it deciding what would be the case to launch in the pilot? Like, what do you remember you and Robert discussing for that?
Well, we wanted to highlight that Elsbeth was an outsider. Mm-hmm. We wanted to find a world that was somewhat pretentious mm-hmm. and specific to New York. And this idea of performance mm-hmm. and someone who was cutting through performance mm-hmm. just was very appetizing to us.
I think it also, actually, the pilot brings up a question that sort of hangs over the entire character and series, which is, when is she acting and when is she not, you know? Mm-hmm. And we don't always decide. I mean, Carrie doesn't always decide. She plays everything real, but, you know, how much of it is naive and how much of it is absolutely calculated? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, this season we've seen her sort of sniff out like a tennis player's father killing the competitor, the Andy Cohen light, you know, reality TV producer offing one of his starlets. What makes for a good case for Elsbeth, and how much are you thinking about New York as a backdrop to this?
We think of New York all the time. Where, you know, I always say, like, pay attention to page 6 every day in mm-hmm. New York Magazine and what, you know. Basically, what makes a good case is something that everyone in the writer's room goes, oh, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something I learned from working with Robert and Michelle, that so much of doing this kind of show or any show is feeling the temperature in the writer's room of when something is really hot and, mm-hmm. and everyone's excited mm-hmm. because that's then you know there's something there.
Well, I also know that you're not big on violence. I don't know how you feel about it, but the use of a gun is maybe used once this season, is
once,
what you said?
Once, the finale is the only time we use a gun.
Okay. What challenge does that create, or is it more creatively freeing to think outside the box?
It forces us to come up with something that's a little bit more creative. Mm-hmm. I hate violence. Mm-hmm. I'm just, you know. It's not my thing. Uh-huh. And I don't think that's where I don't think a show starring Elsbeth Tassioni solving crimes is one where it's you want to see a lot of blood or gore or that kind of anger. It just doesn't feel right tonally.
It's the anti-grit show.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Elsbeth and Poker Face, which is another series that pays homage to Columbo, they both show the audience, obviously, who the culprit is at the beginning of the episode. What do you enjoy about Solve This With Us versus the whodunit approach to the mystery series?
I think the big difference, and either I love Poker Face too, and there are certain many differences that I feel, oh, we're not doing the same thing, thank God. But I think the big difference is there are always scenes where the audience knows something that Elsbeth doesn't. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have that mm-hmm. if you didn't do the whodunit mm-hmm. format. And so the real fun of watching an actor play a character who is lying and we know for a fact they're lying mm-hmm. is different. It's a different kind of fun. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, we are breaking form sometimes, and sometimes we are not always playing it the same way. But when I started, I thought, oh, God, this is going to be so hard to keep coming up with these. In a way that's satisfying, and like you usually show the murder, but you don't always show all the clues that how she's going to. We try to dole out the information so there are twists and turns, but I kind of feel freed by it a little bit. I've learned that it's sort of like working in the sonata form, you know, like you have a basic form that you can keep pushing at the edges of and try to find new ways to do it, but mm-hmm. still come up to a satisfactory conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Shows that are similar, at least on paper, are not uncommon in Hollywood. And I know for me as a writer, knowing that when I'm writing about a show, there's probably 5 other outlets, 10 other outlets
right.
doing something
of
similar.
Course.
When in the development process did you hear about Poker Face, and how do you sort of not let that sort of infiltrate how you think about the show?
We certainly had the idea before we knew that that was
in the works.
Or a thing. Mm-hmm. I can't remember at what point we saw the show. Here's what I will say. Robert and I have never developed a show where there wasn't a competing show. Mm-hmm. I no longer give it a minute's thought because it is always the case. Mm-hmm. And fine, mm-hmm. so either we get on the air or we don't. Mm-hmm.
It's a very different slice of life and world, and Charlie is a very different character than Elsbeth. Also, they do something that is kind of wonderful, but I don't think would work for us, is the way they play with the timeline much mm-hmm. more thoroughly than we ever do. Mm-hmm. Usually, because what they do is usually you see the whole crime, and then you go back and you see how Charlie was actually there the mm-hmm. whole time. I think that would be hard, first of all, with our time limitations and also being on network, where it takes, I think, more concentration to mm-hmm. to follow than we can count on necessarily mm-hmm. Thursday nights at 10 on CBS.
Right.
And also they have... The device that Charlie's able to tell when someone's lying, which mm-hmm. we don't have. Mm-hmm. So I felt those were different enough. The voice is very different, and you can't worry about it. Yeah, the world is totally different.
Yeah.
I mean, we're
absolutely
much more dust.
Right. Yeah. Well, Michelle, I mean, well, both of you have experience working on network and then having shows on streaming. Obviously, The Good Fight and Evil at least started on network, but went to streaming. What did you enjoy about the thought of returning to network TV with a procedural like this?
We never were anti-network. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what I enjoy about having it on network, mm-hmm. which is so many more people are seeing it and enjoying it and letting us know. And that's terrific. Mm-hmm. That's just great fun of being able to reach a wider swath of folks rather than, that they have to put down their $10.99 a month
right.
or whatever it is.
Right, right. Well, John, you're in the position where you're carrying out the vision set by Michelle and Robert. Obviously, you guys wrote the pilot. Were you hesitant about that? Of like, how do I carry out that vision, or is it a nice challenge for you?
Yes. tell me if I'm wrong, but Robert and Michelle wrote the pilot. And everything you see in the pilot was there, but they've given me a lot of freedom beyond that to find it as we go. And then, of course, they see every story and as we go. And I don't feel like hemmed in. Like I don't have to think all the time. Like, will Robert and Michelle like this?
Okay.
I think we sort of understand what the show
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What does a Robert or a Michelle note look like?
they're worried about tonnage. do we have too much of, it's always, because we're always, as we said, Elspeth is a character that you can have.
A heavy dose of.
Too much of, you have to always find just enough and just not do too much, things like that. It's more about that. It's more about, like, making sure we all feel like, yes, we're on the right path.
Mm-hmm. Does that feel like a bigger challenge when you have, I know the guest star each week is, like, the fourth character, but otherwise you've got three, which is... The captain, Elspeth, and Kaya, right?
Kaya. Yeah, Officer Kaya.
I was going to say Kara.
No, I really did that wrong. Hired a Carrie and a Kara and to play a Kaya. And no, that was a terrible error.
And how about in the writer's room, we have Eric, Erica, and Erica.
Like when you have basically three main characters and you want to make sure the dosage of Elspeth is right, like is that a challenge when it's not like a full ensemble?
I'll tell you, the challenge for me was we have the demands of the procedural, and we've got three characters, wonderful actors who we want to make sure we keep involved. And Columbo, you barely knew anybody else. I mean, he basically would go into the like occasionally they would have Stephen Gilborn as the medical examiner, and so it's been a challenge to find ways to make sure we were keeping our three interacting with each other and integral to the plot. And I think we have. I mean, I think we've managed to find a way to keep that investigation that Elspeth's been, certainly online, everyone's into that more than I thought they would be, about her investigation into Captain Wagner.
What's a crucial quality you've come to realize is necessary for a showrunner? And what did observing Robert and Michelle during their time sort of teach you?
Unflappability and calm.
I
think the best thing I learned.
I can never be a showrunner then.
Yeah. I mean, the best thing I always remember times when it felt like things weren't working. And I do this now because Robert always did this in the room. He would just state where we are and what we are trying to figure out at this moment. Mm-hmm. Nothing else matters. Or like suddenly an actor who you had been planning this whole episode around is unavailable, you do not get emotional about it. You get, okay, what are the options? And you just have to move forward. This is it's a train on a track, and you have hundreds of people waiting for the next script, and you just, emotion does not help you in this job. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, no, you're so right. I mean, the trick is always to fall forward. It's not thinking there are not going to be obstacles and you won't stumble. It's always, how do we fall forward? It's funny, I hadn't thought about this in years, but a friend was working with a basketball player on a different thing, and the basketball player didn't show up, and I realized, oh, we had that happen to us.
I remember that.
On Good Wife.
Yeah.
And
what do you do?
What do? You rewrite. And suddenly, there is no basketball player, it's their agent, and their agent has to, you know, because you can't spend your life getting upset about who shows up on set. If they don't show up on set, you better figure out something else to film.
And the audience doesn't know what happened.
Right.
Until
so
you just have to make it as good.
LA Times video podcast.
I mean, like this year, you know, episode 5, which was the tennis episode, mm-hmm. it was written by a wonderful writer, Eric Randall, and Eric was expecting a baby. And so I wanted to move his episode earlier so it wouldn't conflict. And everyone thought that agreed that was a good idea. But it meant we were shooting in a very cold time of year. Okay. So we had an arrangement with one place that would have been perfect. But then that perfect place said, there's a murder? No, you can't shoot here. And so we had to scramble and we had to make our own tennis court. And we,
wow.
You know, but you just, and we have, you know, Gail Barringer, who's our line producer and is, you know, a co-executive producer, talk about unflappable. What can we do? What can we do?
Let's talk more about the guest stars because, you know, as you said, sometimes the episodes change, but like, I imagine, did you have a dream list going into this? How do you decide who works for whatever character or episode you're trying to do? Because I imagine scheduling these very great guest stars is a challenge.
I have to say, because of that, we don't write to the performer. At least we haven't yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, we may be in a position now where the show is established. I'm mm-hmm. hoping some people might say, I really want to do an Elsbeth. This is when I'm free. And then maybe we can do that. Although I don't trust it when they say that.
It'll never happen.
But no, so we just really just write characters. And then Finley Davidson is our casting director and I and the writer of the episode. And we just start the conversation and we make our lists and we just go.
We've obviously heard a lot about Elsbeth's son this season. And we... Obviously, he unintentionally gets into an entanglement with Captain Wagner in terms of him sort of exerting his influence. Are we going to see Elsbeth's son?
Maybe. I mean, you never saw Mrs. Columbo until she got her own series. Uh-huh. So, you know, watch out for Teddy Tassioni coming this fall. You know, that came about because when Robert and Michelle asked me to do this, I went and watched every episode Elsbeth ever appeared in. And I've been saying it's the first episode. It's actually the second episode she appeared in on The Good Wife, where she mentions her son set her up with her computer. Mm-hmm. So we went back. We figured, okay, well, he was maybe like 10 years old then. So we figured he's mid-20s now. And we just thought, well, she's a mother. And what kind of kid would she have? What kind of mother would she be? And it's opened up a really lovely stuff for the character. And then we decided to bring Teddy in for the... But I don't know. I don't know what we're going to do yet. We'll
see. I know we're keeping the world separate, and this is very much not thought about as a spinoff, but we did hear also a mention of Cary Agos. Do you see a world eventually down the line where there might be these characters dropping in, or it's like a TBD at this point?
You going to pay for them? I mean, you know, there are sort of practical... I mean, I love that a lot of fans of TV shows think of characters as like crayons that you can just pick up mm-hmm. and use. But we still have the demands of our show, the setting of our show, the fact that we're in New York, and just in terms of a budget of how much we can do in an episode, there are a lot of considerations. I would love to have those people visit. Mm-hmm. The problem is, you know, so much of our budget goes to who's the murderer. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to see anyone from, you know, I don't want to see Diane Lockhart kill someone. So... I would love it if we can work it out down the line. But again, this is a show that it's not really a spinoff, and it is set in New York. And I say, I've got friends in Chicago. I rarely see them.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. You know, we're about a year since the writer's strike went into effect. What are you finding are the shifts or changes since you've gotten back to work? Is it things like the budget? Like, what feels especially different?
There is certainly an awareness of budget. Look, network television was always budget conscious. Mm-hmm. It has become more budget conscious. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I gotta say, for me, it's how many people I know who are out of work and how I wish I could hire them all.
Oh.
And I can't.
Yeah.
Do you find that you're thinking about streaming hours or algorithm in the ways that you were thinking about ratings? Or how does it sort of factor into your everyday process as a creative?
Not at all for me.
I was going to say, I don't know about you, John, not at all.
I barely have enough time to try to make the show good. You know, that's all you can do.
We know that the show's renewed for a season two. When are things going to pick back up in the writer's room for you?
Do we wrap up here?
I think by the end of the month.
Does your notes app have cases you're already thinking about or guest stars you hope to get for season two?
Cases, certainly. But I mean, because we only had 9 new episodes to do in season one, we had a much longer list than 9 of things. So there's a bunch we'll go back to.
Okay.
And every once in a while, something will happen, and I'll just go, oh. Yeah, I'm always looking for fun ways to murder people.
Well, I'm very excited for the return of the series when it comes back next season. It's been such a delight to watch, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
It's
good
a pleasure.
See you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And that'll do it for this week's episode of The Envelope. Please like and subscribe anywhere that you watch or listen to podcasts, and join us again for another episode next week.